So this is the last Sunday of our Greater Is He series, where we're talking about enemies and conflict and all manner of things, and this might be the one that you like the least. So I'm just preparing you. If you want to leave right now, you're welcome to. If you stay, then just know that you're not going to like it. Okay, everybody's staying. Good. Okay, so as we dig in, I want you to think, if you are, Leanna's leaving. It's bye, Leanna. See you. She's like, I'm done. I'm out. How do you prepare when you are about to step into a conflict zone? And when I say conflict zone, I mean like maybe at work you have to have an uncomfortable meeting with your boss. How do you prepare for that? Or if you're a parent and you've got a teenager, like you've got to like have a difficult conversation with your teenager. You're not looking forward to it, but you know you need to do it. Like, how do you prepare for that? What do you do? Because I think when I think about like different people will prepare for conflict in different ways. Like even like when you're getting ready for a sporting event, right? And the enemy is going to be resisting you on the court of sport. Like a couple of the things that we do, like I know there's one kind of person that before they step into conflict, they want to get like super psyched up, right? They'll go get like their favorite high energy song and start beating on their chest and rah, let's get them, right? They get their adrenaline up before they step into the conflict. That's one way to prepare. Another way that some people prepare is the exact opposite, where they will like get into this like quiet, meditative, like peaceful space where they just want like, you know, just calm, deep breaths, right? And I think maybe the last idea that I had regarding how people prepare is that there are some people, they don't want to get like psyched up and they don't want to like calm super down. But some people will get like super mentally prepared. They'll run through like, if this, then that. I'm going to say this. I'm going to do this. Here's my plan and my strategy. I know the tactics of the person or the team or the whatever I'm going against. And so here's how I'm going to counteract that. If they do this, then I'm going to do this. They prepare by getting mentally prepared to step in to the conflict. But there's so many different ways that each of us like to get prepared to step into those spaces where we're going to face resistance and opposition. Now, it's interesting in Matthew chapter 4 where we've been. Jesus is ready to step into some big time conflict with the ancient serpent foe, Satan himself. And we get a behind the scenes glimpse into seeing how the Father chooses to prepare Jesus before heading into that conflict. And here's what the Father does, right? Right before Jesus goes in to face the enemy in the wilderness, Jesus gets baptized. He comes up out of the waters of baptism. This is the last thing that we read before Jesus goes out into the wilderness. And here's what the Father says, right? There's sometimes before my kids have a match or a meet or a game, like I'll pull them aside. I'll have some words for them before they step in. Here's the Father saying some things to Jesus before he steps into this epic battle. Here's what he says. And behold, a voice from heaven spoke over Jesus and said, "This is my beloved Son with whom I am well pleased." Jesus is going into the first epic battle of his life. The Father prepares him, speaking these words, "This is my beloved Son with whom I am well pleased." I just want to break that down, three parts. First part is my beloved. What that speaks to is a deep relationship that is riddled with affection. My beloved, right? The baseline is, Jesus, I love you. You're going to go out there into this epic 40-day battle. I just want you to know before you go out there, like, don't get psyched up. Don't just calm down. Don't just get mentally prepared. Here's what I need you to know. I need you to know before you head out there that I love you, my beloved. And then he says this, my beloved Son. He wants Jesus to remember who he is. That he is a son of the Father. That's an identity statement. He says, before you head out into this conflict zone, I need you to know that you were loved, and I need you to know who you are. You are my son. Don't forget that. And then the last thing is, he says, with whom, Jesus, with you, I am well pleased. This is a statement of dignity and approval. that the Father is bestowing upon Jesus like a royal robe before Jesus has done anything. Remember, Jesus is about to begin his ministry. He's about to step into a conflict zone with the enemy to be sharpened and prepared for his ministry. He hasn't done anything yet. Jesus hasn't gotten his report card back. He hasn't beaten the enemy yet. He hasn't healed anybody. He hasn't taught anybody. He's done zero in terms of his public ministry. But before he has done anything, the Father says, "I am well pleased with you." He wants Jesus to know that his dignity and his approval has been bestowed upon him. It is not dependent upon what or how he does. "My beloved, deep love, my son, identity, I am well pleased. You are loved and you are mine before you do anything. You do not earn these things. They are bestowed. Now, from the place of this bestowed honor, go. Go into the conflict. You can do it." And then Jesus goes into the conflict, which we've spoken about for many weeks. And after the conflict, then Jesus begins to teach in the Sermon on the Mount. And there's a point where he speaks about enemies. I want to see what Jesus says about enemies, because Jesus knows what it takes to engage in conflict with an enemy and overcome. Jesus, help us. Here's what Jesus says, Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 5, verse 43. This is where it gets to the part where you're not going to like it. Just preparing you. Here we go. Jesus says, "You have heard that it was said, 'You shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy.'" It's the conventional wisdom of the day. All the religious leaders were saying this: love your neighbor, hate your enemy. It just makes sense. It's just conventional, run-of-the-mill, normal, quote-unquote, wisdom. Everybody says this. Verse 44, but, okay, Jesus is going to defy conventional wisdom, and he's going to give a different operative command here. He says, "But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be sons and daughters of your Father who is in heaven." Okay, now, I think what we have to do here is, real quick, we have to differentiate the different kinds of enemies and oppositions and resistance that we're going to face in the life that we live. The first kind of enemy that we're going to face is a dark spiritual principality, power, force. And they're non-human. I don't know how to explain. It's beyond my pay grade to tell you what they are or how long they've existed. I just don't know those things. But what I do know is that there's dark powers in high places that are set on undoing what God is seeking to do in your life and resisting the things that he wants to do. Now, regarding those enemies, those are not the enemies that Jesus is speaking of here in Matthew 5. We're not called to love those enemies and to pray for these dark spiritual powers. We're not. What we're called to do is we're called to resist and to wrestle against these spiritual powers of darkness, right? Resist them, right? But the other category of enemy, or those who would present themselves to us as enemies and seek to oppose or resist or undermine what it is that we're seeking to do and the Lord is seeking to do in us, we'll call these people, human beings, fellow image bearers. That's who Jesus is speaking about here in Matthew 5 when he says, "Love your enemies." Dark spiritual forces we resist. Human beings who present themselves as enemies to us, we are called to love and pray for. Right? Ephesians 6:12 says it this way. Like, Paul will make it very clear. He says, "For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood." Right? Don't fight against. Don't go after your human person enemy. Don't wrestle against them. But yes, do wrestle against the rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers over this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in heavenly places. Do fight them. Now, regarding the human enemies that come against us, question, why in the world should we love them? Like, what? Sometimes, like, when you talk to your kids and you say, hey, you can't have dessert before you have dinner. Like one of their great questions, because they perceive it as a gross injustice, is they say, why? Like sometimes we just want to understand, like, love my enemies, those who hate me, those who are speaking ill about me, those who have come to undo the good things I'm trying to do, love and pray for them, right? And why? Why would we do that, God? And I think just in a nutshell, the answer is because that's who God is. God loves his enemies. Romans chapter 5, verse 10. Paul says this about God. For if while we were enemies, meaning God is good, we rebelled, we're opposing, we're undermining, we're maligning, we're, oh, I don't like you, I don't want you, like we're his enemy. For if while we were enemies, we were reconciled to God by the death of his Son, meaning while we presented ourselves as enemies of God, what he did in response is he didn't crush us, power up against us, come and like smash us into the ground. He could have very easily, but he said that's not who God is. What he did to his enemies is he sent his beloved Son, his only Son, whom he loves, and he sent Jesus to the cross to make a way for us to become his friends again. It's just who God is. And I can't tell you why he's that way. I don't know. He is other. He is holy. He is different. But when we present as enemies, what he loves and longs to do is to self-sacrifice, to lay himself down so that we could be friends and have a way to be one with him again. For if while we were enemies, we were reconciled to God by the death of his Son, how much more now that we have been reconciled? We were enemies. Jesus died for us. How much more now shall we be saved by his life? So God is always seeking to make his enemies into his friends, right? It says in the scriptures that God is patient with us, even while we're rebelling against him. He's patient. Why? Because he wants everyone to come back into the family. He wants everybody to come back. And if he crushes us immediately, then there isn't sufficient time for us to maybe come to our senses, throw up our hands and say, I give up. I receive the grace and the kindness. I'm coming back as the prodigal son or daughter comes back. He's patient with us while we're his enemies in order to bring us back. And because he is this way, and that is the good way to operate, he invites us to join him in that. To love our enemies and to pray for them. Now, here's what I want to do right now. We could go and illustrate this in very interpersonal ways. And I think sometimes, if we're honest, we think about like coming to church and reading our Bible and what we think is this is like a personal thing between me and God. And sometimes if we get really daring, maybe it's something that splashes out into some, like maybe a couple relationships that I'm in. But really, like we take our relationship with God and we put it in this very small, very tight box. And there's so many other things that don't fit into this. So what I want to do this morning is I want to illustrate this in several different ways, but in a geopolitical fashion. And my hope is, as we talk about like world history and like civic events of people groups over time and how this plays or doesn't play out, my hope is then that we will be able to see that what Jesus is saying here is true, not just in the tight, small box that we think God exists in our lives, but it is true outside of these walls in every corner and nook and cranny of the universe. Right? Loving our enemies and praying for those who persecute us is the good way to move forward. Let's illustrate. Let's go back to World War I, right? Germany was our great enemy, and thankfully we defeated them, right? Memorial Day weekend, we celebrate those who laid their lives down for the sake of like honoring and defending the good in the world, right? So World War II, we defeat the Germans. Now, here's the deal. After World War I, we had a bunch of soldiers come back to our country, as did England and France. They were fortunate enough to come home from the conflict, but what happened is they had a lot of friends and brothers who they left behind who didn't make it out. And so, like, when you face an enemy who is shooting at you and they're sending bombs to crush you and to destroy you and to break you into bits, and you see your brothers around you getting killed by them, when you come home, that will have a psychological effect on you. They were your enemy, and because they did this, what tends to happen normally is that they continue to be your enemy. And every Memorial Day, we remember, oh, like if you're a soldier in World War I, like you know names of people that you love that died. And you know who killed them. Germans killed my friends, right? And that will reinforce in your psyche, I hate Germans. And that's natural and normal. And here's what we did after World War I. We and England and France, all the Allies joined together. Because the Germans had aggressed, they were in the wrong, they killed us, right? It was an epic battle. It was terrible and horrific in so many ways. What we did after the war, when we had already defeated them, is we punished them further. We put loads of debt on them, because if they started this conflict, well, doggone it, they're going to pay for it. And so burden them with debt, obligations to pay over time. And we restricted them economically and militarily, like we muted and thwarted their economy because we didn't want to see them get strong again. In every way that we could, because they were our enemies and we didn't want to see them ever rise again, we just sought to like stuff them down, okay? Now, if you're a German living in Germany post-World War I, you also got some brothers and friends that have died, and now you're living in an environment where your country has been destroyed, and now it's the French, and it's the English, and it's the Americans who are oppressing us and keeping us down. That'll do something in your heart, too. It'll fester anger and vitriol and vengeance and a desire to just, like, be done with you. And it was in that atmosphere that a fellow by the name of Adolf Hitler and the Nazi regime started to take a foothold, because everybody was so mad and so wanted to crush the people that were crushing their society and their economy and all the things. The Germans looked at Hitler and said, "That's our guy." And they looked at the Nazis and might not have agreed with all the doctrines, but they said, "Hey, you guys are talking strong. We've been waiting for someone to talk strong because we got to crush all these people who are coming down on us." And so in this environment where we continue to treat the Germans as enemies, Hitler rises to power, Nazi Party rises to power, and then what happens is World War II. We were enemies of Germany in World War I. We chose to continue to be their enemy after the war, and they just postured themselves as our enemy, and World War II was the result. And what a horror World War II was. And then World War II happens. And American soldiers go, British, French as well, and many of our soldiers died. Memorial Day weekend, thank you for laying your lives down. Many of these soldiers then, after the war, victory, right? We defeated the Germans. We defeated Japan. We come home. These same soldiers come home, right? And they know that Germany and Japan were both our enemies. They tried to kill me. They remember all the bullets and bombs that were coming. They know the names of their brothers who didn't make it back home. Same psychological parallels to World War I. Like, you come back, and I'm guessing most of those soldiers didn't like the Germans and didn't like the Japanese. But at least nationally, we decided to deal with the Germans and the Japanese differently after World War II than we did after World War I. Here's what we did at the end of World War II. We came alongside the Germans and the Japanese. And we actually helped to repair and to rebuild. We bombed their cities into oblivion, and then we decided to come alongside and help them rebuild. We extended the hand that used to be a fist into a handshake of beginning friendship. and we started to align our economies, and we started to share technology, and our businesses started to go in and start rebuilding commerce. We made treaties with them where we promised not to come back and to crush them. We didn't put severe limitations nor debt burdens on them. We did not treat them as continuing enemies. And we promised to defend them if anybody else decided to step against them. It's a different response than our response after World War I. And after 80 years, 79 years since World War II ended, do you know in the world who our two besties are? Bestie means best friends, if you don't know that. I think it's probably like an old school way of saying it. Outside of France and England, who have been for a couple hundred years since the Revolutionary War, that is. But outside of those traditional allies, the Germans and the Japanese have been our best friends. Great affection, shared economies for each other, military alliances. You mess with them, you mess with us. We're friends with our former enemies because we chose not to continue to deal with them and treat them as ongoing enemies. So Jesus says, love your enemies. Okay, everyone that's listening to the Sermon on the Mount knows that Jesus means the person that lives next door to me that plays their music too loud. The neighbors in the apartment above me who, for whatever reason, on Friday nights, like, it seems like they're tap dancing, I don't know, and they do it until 2 a.m. Like, why? Stop it, please! Like they know when Jesus says, love your enemies, they know that Jesus is speaking about the people in close proximity to them. That's hard. That's hard. But over time, what becomes painstakingly obvious is that Jesus isn't just talking about the neighbor upstairs who tap dances and the people on your block who don't take care of their lawn and play their music too loud. It's beyond that. It's more than that. He's also talking geopolitically here. For the people that Jesus is listening to, they would know, if not now, then for sure in a couple teachings later, that Jesus is referring to their mortal enemy, the Roman Empire. Love your enemies. Love the Romans? Yes. When Jesus says, go the extra mile, that's not some vague euphemism for like, let the neighbors tap dance for another 15 minutes before you call them and say, could you please stop? I'm trying to sleep. It applies to that, but the extra mile literally was a first century thing that every Jewish person understood, that in the Roman Empire, the Roman soldier had an edict from Caesar that on their travels from one place to the next to defend the Pax Romana, which really wasn't a peace, because everywhere they went, they brought aggression. And anyway, wherever a Roman soldier is traveling from one place to the next, Caesar edicted that these soldiers need not have to carry all their equipment on their own. But all the vanquished and conquered peoples of their empire, at any point a soldier could say, hey, you, now, come carry my stuff, because I don't want to carry it. You already don't like the soldier. You don't like them because they're the mortal enemy. They're oppressing your land. They're muting and thwarting and undermining all the things that you think will make life good. You already don't like them. And now they say, you, come carry my stuff for the next mile. That's going to be an inconvenience. Yeah. Jesus says, now, as you're walking with the soldier, love them. Don't treat them as an enemy. Love them. And then Jesus says, now, just to make sure that we're getting practical in our love, here's how we're going to do that. Caesar says you got to go 1 mile with him. In the kingdom of Jesus, if you're going to be my follower, we're going to love him enough to go an extra mile. They know that you don't have to do that. Legally, you can go home after the mile. But we're going to show them that we love them by doing what we don't need to do. That's how we're going to communicate our different posture towards them. So what Jesus is doing here is he is offering Israel an opportunity to do two things. Opportunity number one is to receive the love of the Father. The Father says, this is my beloved Son with whom I am well pleased. The Father invites all of us into that beloved, loving, relational, approval, worth, validating space. He wants to meet us there in his affection and in his kindness. He is offering that to the people of Israel right now and to the world. But he starts with Israel. So he's offering Israel an opportunity to receive his love, and then, after receiving his love, an opportunity to extend and give his love out to the world, to the tap dancing neighbor, to the loud partier at 2 a.m., and to the Roman soldier. He's inviting us to live out his love to all of our perceived and past enemies. Now, what happens in the Gospels is that by and large, Israel rejects this offer. It's like at a voting poll. Like there are some, the disciples, the 72, some among the crowds, but few. There are some who say, yes, Jesus, I want to follow you in your way. The vast majority of the people that Jesus is extending this offer to say, no, thank you very much. And so when Jesus comes into Jerusalem before he goes to the cross to make a way for us to abide in his love, as he steps into Jerusalem, Jesus looks at Jerusalem and he starts to speak. And he's not just speaking private, personal spirituality in a tight-knit box that we like because it's comfortable. Jesus now is speaking over Jerusalem in a geopolitical fashion. Follow me here and I'll explain it. Jesus is coming into Jerusalem, and here's what Luke says. Luke chapter 19, verse 41. And when Jesus drew near and saw the city, he wept over it. Jesus sees Jerusalem and just starts breaking down in tears. And here's why. Here's what Jesus says. Would that you, Jerusalem, even you, if you had known on this day the things that make for peace. Jesus invites us into the love of God and into extending the love of God. That's what makes peace. It's the only thing that makes peace. And the offer has been extended and by and large rejected. Then Jesus says, but now these things are hidden from your eyes. And he's crying here. For the days will come upon you when your enemies will set up a barricade around you and surround you and hem you in on every side, Jerusalem. And they will tear you down to the ground, you and your children within you. And they will not leave one stone upon another in you because you did not know the time of your visitation. It's not just private spirituality that Jesus is speaking of here. He's saying, Israel, you've rejected sitting in the place of the Father's love. And because of that, you're not able to receive the Father's love. You've also rejected Jesus' invitation to love your enemies. And so what's going to happen in almost 40 years is that Israel is going to revolt against Rome. They're going to continue to see the Romans as their mortal enemies. They're going to hate them. They're going to despise them. They're going to want to crush them. And behind closed doors, they're going to strategize how to push them out with violent force. And they did. Let me say this. They sought to. And then in AD 70, the Roman general Titus, who would eventually become Caesar himself, Titus and his army besieged Jerusalem for 5 months. At the end of that 5 months, they broke through the walls and they obliterated Jerusalem and much of the surrounding territories, just as Jesus said. Jesus is weeping because he sees a city that is rejecting his way of treating his enemies with a peace and a love that solves these problems before they happen. Remember when Jesus is walking with his disciples and his disciples see the temple and they say, wow, what a magnificent structure. And then Jesus says, hey guys, I tell you the truth, not one of these stones will be left upon another. Jesus isn't speaking about some apocalyptic future. He's speaking about AD 70 when the Romans will literally destroy the temple and every other building in Jerusalem because his people rejected his way of love and peace. It happened. Not personal, private spirituality behind closed doors. Geopolitically, this is the truth. What a different way forward he offers us. You guys know the name Nelson Mandela. Nelson Mandela, this is geopolitical again, right? Lived in apartheid South Africa as a black man. White minority oppressing a black majority. And it was pretty nasty, even into the 1980s, when we're sophisticated and beyond all that. So we thought South Africa was in the thick of racial oppression. Nelson Mandela, as a black man, spends 27 years unjustly in a prison. 27 years. I don't like it when something of an injustice happens to me for 27 minutes. Brother gets mad. 27 years is a laborer under the hot, oppressive sun breaking rocks. He didn't do anything wrong. He just sought to fight injustice. 27 years later, Nelson Mandela comes out. And there's two options when you come out. There's two paths forward. Option one would be the normal path forward. The normal path is, you white people, I hate you. Now that I'm out, you made me an enemy. Now I'm going to crush you. That's the normal path. I get that. I understand Malcolm X. I read the biography and I empathize with him. I feel empathy for that response. I get it. But it's the normal response. The other response is to step out and say, you white people see me as your enemy, but I'm going to choose not to see you as my enemy. And then 1994, Nelson Mandela comes to the presidency. Watch out! You imprisoned him for 27 years. You made him an enemy. You ruined his life. Now he's sitting in the position of power. Watch out, white folks. He's coming for you. Revenge. Vengeance is mine, saith Nelson Mandela. But that's not what he did. Because he didn't go the normal path. He went the Jesus path. And what he did is he took an apartheid, divided, racially segregated, and oppressive country, and in the middle, he just grabbed both sides and he pulled them together. And he was able to do that because his heart wasn't divided. He had a whole, healed heart that was full of love. Somehow, in the midst of the chaos that he lived in, the Lord did a miracle in him. And because the Lord did a miracle in his heart, a miracle was able to happen through his heart in the nation of South Africa. And South Africa today is a thriving country that is, it has not arrived yet. It is in process. But wow, it is so much better than it was because one man sought the path of love and forgiveness and peace, and he laid himself down for his enemies. Is this loving your enemies thing personal? Yes. Is it national? Yes. Is it geopolitical, international? Yes. So yeah, you got neighbors. And maybe the Lord is right now bringing a couple neighbors to your mind who you just don't like. They've presented themselves as your enemies. Jesus is talking about them. Love them. Pray for them. But if you're a Democrat, he's also calling you to love on some Republicans. And if you're a staunch Republican, he's also calling on you to love and to pray for some Democrats, right? Wouldn't that be an interesting thing? Instead of throwing grenades over the political wall, what if whoever the guy is you're not going to vote for, what if we just started praying for that person? That's the Jesus way. And that's what he invites us into. I think some things would change if enough people just started doing that, right? Rich, poor, black, white, old, young, right? Some of the ways where there's tension in our culture, right? What Jesus calls us to do is not to enemy up and to push and to fight and to retaliate, right? But to love and to pray for. If you're an Ohio State fan, maybe this fall we need to start praying for some Wolverines. Can we do that? Praise Jesus. Right? I heard a boo. I understand. I empathize with that boo. I get it. But our call is to love our enemies. Abraham Lincoln said this, back to the geopolitical, right? This plays out in the real world, not just in what we perceive to be a private, behind the closed door spirituality, just me and Jesus. This is far beyond that. It's meant to be lived out in the world. Abraham Lincoln said this, and my friend Brian Bell, thank you for pointing me to this. Abraham Lincoln, here it is. In a speech Abraham Lincoln gives during the height of the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln is a northerner, and he's speaking about his southerner opposition. Most people would say our enemies. They're shooting at us. They're fighting us. They're killing our brothers and sisters. They're enslaving people, right? In a speech that Abraham Lincoln delivered at the height of the Civil War, he referred in this speech to southerners as fellow human beings who were in great error. An elderly lady in this speech chastises him for not calling Southerners irreconcilable enemies who must be destroyed. I get it. I understand the older woman's sentiment. Maybe she lost a son in the war. I don't know. But I understand her vengeance and vitriol. But this is Lincoln's reply. He says, "Why, madame," Lincoln replied, "do I not destroy my enemies when I make them my friends?" Civil War ends. The North defeats the South. Praise the Lord for that victory. What does the North do? The North steps in order to reconstruct. We did not do to the South what we did to the Germans after World War I. Had we done that, how many more civil wars would we have had? I do not know. Probably more than one. But we came alongside in the same way that Lincoln said, they are fellow human beings, but they are in error. We've addressed the error. We've defeated that. Now we're going to come alongside them and help rebuild. And now we have it seems like it's questionable day to say this, but we have a United States of America. Because Lincoln chose a specific way forward in dealing with his perceived enemies. This is an invitation to live in the love of God and to receive the goodness of God personally, so that from that place we can live out the love of God interpersonally and geopolitically. All of the above. I said this is going to be like the one that we hate the most. Loving our enemies and praying for those that persecute us. That's a hard message, Jesus. That is a tough pill to swallow. I just want to say this. That is not a moral teaching that we are able to receive and go implement on our own. It is impossible for us to love our enemies. We can do what Jesus says here, right? Jesus says in Matthew 5, "For if you love those who love you, what reward do you have?" Right? Do not even tax collectors do the same? And if you greet only your brothers and sisters, what more are you doing than anybody else? Like, everybody loves those who are nice to them. We can do that. It's not hard. But Jesus says, in my kingdom, as you receive and abide in my love, we're going to love our enemies. The only way for us to do that is to abide in his love first. And behold, a voice from heaven said, and I want you to picture yourself here. This is my beloved son, Brian. This is my beloved son, Nick. This is my beloved daughter, Ashley. This is my beloved daughter, Megan, with whom I am well pleased. He speaks his affection over us. Because he knows that we can't give out a love that we are not living in. And from that place, he calls us to live in his love and live out his love and to love those who present as enemies to us. Or as Paul would say in Romans 12:18, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with all people. Band, come on back up. We're going to pray. And they're going to lead us. We're going to just end here, but if I could draw your attention to, we talked about a lot of things. If I could just draw your attention to one specific place to linger in this next song, it would be this. Right? It's not right now, think of your top five enemies and write their names down and go bless them and love them this week. Pray for them. That's not it. It's getting the cart ahead of the horse. But the take home is, Father, you love me. You call me beloved, and you call me a son and a daughter, and you say that you are pleased with me before I have done anything, and even in the midst of me doing wrong. Right? That is the privileged space that he invites us into, and he wants us to dwell there. That's the invitation right now. Just think about that. Just receive, as we sing this song, just receive his love that has been poured out over us by the death of his son, right? That is the visible demonstration of his love, where he made a way back for us to join the family again. We were his enemies. He made us not just his friends, but he made us family. Just receive his love, right? This is the party when the prodigal comes home, and it's a festive celebration. Let's enter into the party just for a song. Can we do that? It's all we need to do. And I just want to pray that over us right now. Father, I pray that above all things, that you would quiet our minds and our hearts about anything and everything else, and that you, as a loving and attentive Father who spoke words over Jesus, Father, I pray that you would be so personal as to speak your affection over each and every one of us now, that we would know, that we would know, that we would know that we are loved by you. It's not because of anything that we have done, and there's nothing that we have done that could undo that love, because you sent Jesus to lay himself down, to cover over all of it, so that we would no longer rebel and fight against you and hate you, but so that you would bring us back into the family of love and peace. And Father, I pray that we would just, as sons and daughters, just enjoy your presence and your affection, your unmerited favor over us. And that's it. Give us a heart that is rooted and established in your love so that we can draw from it and be your people in that place. Thanks for speaking your affection over us. We receive it in Jesus' name. And now we sing. Amen.